Committee come to order. It is 1:33 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 31st, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business today. We have Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We have several matters before the committee today. And the first up is a confirmation hearing for, her full name is Antoinette Malott, but I understand she goes by Tony. She's here with us. Ms. Malott, if you come forward. Ms. Malott is a nominee to the Legislative Ethics Committee. I'm sure the members know what that is. We have Ms. Malott's resume and a letter expressing her interest. Welcome to the committee. I understand you just went through this process over in the other body.
We did.
So you're an experienced hand now. You know to introduce yourself.
I hope so.
Introduce yourself, state your affiliation, if any, and tell us why you'd like to serve on the Ethics Committee.
My name is Antoinette Malott, and I have lived in Juneau for over 30 years. Can you say affiliation?
It's a formality. I think at this level, you're probably not affiliated with anybody. Sometimes people speak on behalf of companies or organizations.
I'm speaking on behalf of myself.
That's the right answer.
And I'm a retired school teacher. We raised three children here, two which live here, and we have grandchildren here. We spend part of our time in Juneau and in Yakutat, where we're involved in the community, and I do a part-time job for Catholic Community Services as a care coordinator for elders in Yakutat, and volunteer up at the school there, and have also volunteered in classrooms here in Juneau.
Sure.
Just to keep my hands in education.
Good for you.
And
what piqued your interest in the Legislative Ethics Committee?
Well, I was telling the other committee that Chief Justice Carpenetti called and immediately said hi and then turned the phone over to Byron. And they talked for a while, and then Byron handed the phone back to me. And that's when Judge Carpenetti asked if I would have an interest in serving. And he said that they were looking for a person from Southeast Alaska, a woman, and someone that could add diversity to the committee. And I said, well, you know, I think I can add diversity, and I'm a fair person, you know. I told him I would think about it for a week and let him know, and I did.
Excellent. And have you ever, since you've expressed your interest and sort of taken this step forward, have you had the opportunity to listen in or watch any of the meetings of the Ethics Committee?
No, I have not.
Okay.
I mean, just recently? Like, mm-hmm. No.
Right. There's no reason, there's no obligation that you have to. I'm just, I guess, mm-hmm. seeing whether you're familiar.
But I have been reading the booklet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they've told you what you do. You hear, I mean, you deal with a lot of matters, but I've
right.
served on the committee, and you know you'll be, probably the most difficult mm-hmm. aspect of your job will be hearing complaints brought against legislators for alleged transgressions
mm-hmm.
of the ethics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're comfortable taking on that job.
Sure.
Okay.
As long as they read the booklet and they know the do's and the don'ts.
Sure. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Questions for Ms. Malott. Mm-hmm. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just a comment, but I see from your resume that you have experience teaching second and third grade, and I would say that probably makes you uniquely qualified.
Oh,
for
yeah,
that.
And kindergarten too. You know, you have to be pretty open and you know, flexible and yeah. So, plus at our school here, I was on the I was the facilitator for site council, and that's dealing with teachers, staff, parents, and
well, thank you for mm-hmm. putting your name forward and agreeing to do this.
Other questions? Senator Coghill.
Not a question, just a comment. I appreciate you mm-hmm. willing to do this.
Thank you.
I think the fairness part is going to be key, but we also have made some very interesting rules to live by,
mm-hmm.
which you know, require a pretty good amount of study as well
mm-hmm.
as application. So I think that fairness that you talked about is going to be a big part of it. We've all here had to deal with it to some degree
mm-hmm.
or another.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we've tried to describe every conceivable circumstance that we might ever get into, and we always miss it.
Yeah, I was reading it and I said, laundry? We have a staff member pick up. I said, okay, so, that's fine.
We look forward to working with you and appreciate your willingness to do it.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Other questions from Ms. Malott? I don't see any. We're ready for a motion.
Yes.
Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the Senate Judiciary Committee move forward the name of Antoinette Malott onto the entire body. And if you'd like, I can read the report.
Go ahead.
In accordance with AS 2460-130, the Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to the Senate for consideration to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, Antoinette Malott. This does not reflect an intent by any member to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, Ms. Malott, congratulations. Your name is going to be forwarded to the full body. That brings up Senate Joint Resolution Number 28 relating to the Ecumenical Patriarchate and Religious Rights, brought to us by our colleague Senator Meyer. We heard the resolution at the last hearing, took public testimony, and just held it over to let members sleep on it. We do have a letter from Stephen Georgeson, the National Coordinator of the State Religious Freedom Resolutions Project, pointing out that this same effort is being made with the Office of the President, the United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, et cetera, and that the effort is going to culminate in the fall with a hand delivery of all the adopted resolutions to Secretary of State Clinton, and that would be forwarded on to the Turkish government. So any other comments or questions? We have a representative from Senator Meyer's office here. Don't hear or see any, and then we would solicit a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, with regards to Senate Joint Resolution 28, I would move that the committee forward this, pass this bill out of committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the resolution is moved. That brings us to Senate CS for House Bill Number 101. We do have a new CS /T we should adopt as our working document.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt version /T.
Is there objection? I'll object for the purposes of discussion and then turn to you, Senator Coghill, or your staffer, whichever you prefer, for an explanation of what you've done.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could have Reneva Moss, my Chief of Staff, step forward. But I can give you the first easy explanation, and then as we get into the details, I'm going to have to lean on her a little bit. She's been doing most of the homework on this, Mr. Chairman. But we did we're in Title IX on this, and as we were moving through the bill, we started off in, I don't have the original bill right there. Sorry. We ended up in the exemption of unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts with what your CS says, but we started off with property exempt without limitations, and we ran into some issues on how to describe that, and it turned out that going back to the exemption of unmatured life insurance contracts was probably the better way to look at it. And it was really with the intention of protecting those livelihood investments and still let people be held accountable for their credit obligations. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to wander way out into a land that I don't understand real well without my staff. So I would have Reneva Moss answer any questions or clarify what I just said.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Moss. And as I recall, we heard this bill last session, and there were some just a couple little issues that came up towards the end of that session. You all agreed generously to work on it over the interim. You've done that. But maybe just to get our orientation, maybe you could just give us a few sentences again about what, you know, the general thrust and the idea behind the bill. Ms. Moss, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reneva Moss, Senator Coghill's staff. Our intern, Amanda, carried this bill last year as part of her internship, and actually the issue was that we had taken the $10,000 exemption for unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts and we had taken it out of that section of law and put it into the 38015, which is property exempt without limitation. And there was some legitimate concern about exempting the entire amount of an unmatured life insurance policy or annuity. So we had an insurance broker go through and make some portfolios on annuities that would be at $250,000 and $500,000, seeing if a $500,000 exemption would allow them a reasonable retirement. And the reason this is important, we feel, is because public retirements are already exempt under state and federal law, but a lot of your blue-collar workers, your small businesses, and people who rely on Social Security, when they get to the time of retirement, they don't have enough income to have a decent living. So this would allow an exemption for up to $500,000. And in your packets, I put some charts that would show you, just as an example, if you have a married couple, male or female, one of them dies, they have a $500,000 policy, their income from that policy would be about $2,600 a month. So we felt it was a reasonable number, and that's how we came up with the $500,000.
Maybe just for my own retirement planning, if you have a $500,000 policy paying $2,600 a month, does that exhaust the principal at the sort of end of your life, or is there something left over for your heirs? How does that work, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I am learning much more about insurance than I care to, but that is a question I can't answer. And is Linda Hulbert online?
She is online. Linda Hulbert from Fairbanks is listening in and willing to testify. Ms. Hulbert, did you hear the question, and are you there?
Yes, I certainly did.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record and state your affiliation, and you can pick up by answering that question and add whatever you'd like to add to the discussion.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. This is Linda Hulbert. I've lived in Fairbanks for 42 years, and I'm associated as a life insurance broker, and I've been doing that for over 20 years.
Okay, thank you. And if you heard the question, please answer it.
Yes. With someone who had either an annuity who wanted to take income from it or the death benefits of a life insurance policy of $500,000. What I did was I ran, and that illustration was provided, I believe, by Reneva Moss. She asked me to do a few calculations. That $500,000 would provide a lifetime income for a couple. And even if one of them died, the other one would continue to get it as long as they were alive. But they could make many choices with that. They could choose to take that over their lifetime. They could choose to have some of it left over for their heirs. They choose what kind of arrangement they want to make. So each individual would decide whether they want to maximize the income throughout their life or get it guaranteed for 20 years, so that it would be for their lifetime, but if they died before the end of 20 years, the rest of it would go to their family. There's lots and lots of choices that each individual would make as to how to use those funds. But $500,000 would provide about $2,500 a month to supplement someone's retirement. And so that was how the $500,000 was arrived upon. And although it would be nice to have an unlimited $500,000, it's certainly sufficient for most Alaskans, most individuals in today's day. So I would support the committee substitute bill.
Ms. Hulbert, thank you. Questions from members of the committee for Ms. Hulbert while we have an expert on the line? I don't hear or see any. Again, thank you. Ms. Moss, anything else you want to add?
No.
Thank you. I have a note, and maybe you can let me know. Do you have the support of labor, the AFL, on this?
Mr. Chairman,
bill?
I did get a phone call from Vince last week, and he started the conversation by saying, "I'd like to help Senator Coghill get a bill passed." And I said, "Be still my heart."
That's a sentence that's never been uttered in the English language before.
So we had a good conversation, and I have been talking to other labor representatives. I see that Vern Marshall is here today, also listening. But yes, the trade unions, I think, are one of the biggest clients for annuities and life insurance to enhance their retirement.
Excellent. Thanks for that information. Further questions from Ms. Moss? Don't hear or see any. This is the first time we've had the opportunity to review this CS. I think it's a big step forward. I commend you and the sponsor for working it, and I really am impressed by that Senator Coghill would leave the House, come here to the Senate to make sure he continues to shepherd this matter forward. It's quite remarkable.
There dedication. Is one other thing, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Because of the CS, we're going to, if we adopt it, the concurrent resolution will have to travel with it as well.
Let's do that as well. I'm going to remove my objection to the adoption of /T as the working document. Is there further objection? If not, the CS is before us. And do we need a motion to sort of put the concurrent resolution before us?
No.
Or just it's a matter that it will just continue to travel with the bill?
Travel with the bill.
That's very good. All right, let's hold this over till Friday, just so everyone has a chance to make sure we're all on board with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up is a bill brought to us by Senator Wilikowski, Senate Bill 190 on biometric information. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have my staff, George Ascott, here. I'll just go through real quickly. I know you heard about this bill in the previous committee. The purpose of this bill is to update a law that is already on the books to protect the privacy rights from emerging new technologies. We already have a law in place introduced by Senator Donnie Olson several years ago, passed unanimously by both bodies of the legislature in 2004, that outlaws the collection, analysis, storage of a law-abiding person's genetic information, or DNA, without their written consent. And what we're trying to do with this bill is to extend that to other forms of biometric information, because we're seeing that this particular area of the ability of through science to collect a person's individual information, whether it's retinal scans or other physiological characteristics, has really exploded. And these emerging technologies threaten our privacy rights, and we have an extremely strong provision in Alaska Constitution, the strongest in the nation. And I think that this really meshes well with our Constitution to do something like this. One of the concerns that we're hearing about is we know that we recently rejected the Federal Real ID Act because of concerns, many different concerns, but one of the big concerns was that it would give the federal government the ability to track people through radio frequency ID chips placed in driver's licenses. And what is happening is now through the ability to track people either through facial recognition technology or through retinal scanning technology, we're seeing this real danger, which impacts people's privacy rights. We were approached by an Alaskan in 2008 who was refused admittance to a state accountancy licensing exam because he refused to submit to fingerprinting, and he offered his driver's license, his passport, his social security card, but they still refused to let him take the CPA exam because he wouldn't give his fingerprint. And he said, "Why do I have to give my fingerprint? I'm not a criminal. I don't have any criminal history or anything like that." And he didn't take his CPA exam because of that. And he really inspired us to go ahead and file this. He has testified previously on this bill. I believe he's out of the country, so I don't think he will be able to testify on this. But I'll stop right there, Mr. Chair. And if there are particular questions that people have, I'm happy to either answer them or more likely have my staff answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I have had this heard this bill, and so I don't have any questions. We do have Mr. Ascott here from your office. We have online to testify Jeffrey Mittman. We also have to answer questions Terry Bannister from our Ledge Legal, and Rick Zabodny is here from the Department of Law. Anything you want to add, Mr. Ascott?
Thank you. For the record, my name is George Ascott, staff to Wilikowski. I would just add that you, in your committee packet, do have an explanation of the changes that have occurred in this CS.
Thank you for that, and I have that in front of my packet. Is this the same CS we saw in Senate State Affairs?
Is this version T, Mr. Chairman?
So we're on the right CS. Yes. Everybody agrees. Okay, very good. Any questions for the bill's sponsor or the bill's sponsor's able staff? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to ask these earlier. It came at me pretty fast, but going to the definition of biometric information, This is pretty broad, and so help me understand, you know, the, for example, there's the hand geometry.
Just for the record, we're on page 3, lines 6 through 8.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
And the, for example, voice recognition. If somebody tape records you, we already have some laws about that, and so I can see where that would be. And then facial recognition, is that the that's different than an iris scan. So could a picture be used? And so just help me understand what the parameters of that are, if they've already been kind of litigated.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, George Ascott here. That question did come up in the last committee hearing, and as far as what a facial recognition technology is and how that differs from a photograph, a facial recognition system is requires three components. One, you have a camera, and second, you would have software which would capture certain proportions in the face and certain things about the image. The software would be beyond just the image, which would be captured by the photograph. And then you'd have a computer system which would classify the various elements and be able to differentiate between different faces. And a photograph is just a photograph, but this is a computer program that is specifically designed.
So, Mr. Chairman, the way I understand it, these are terms of art then that have some pretty valid history behind them already, like voice recognition, for example, over against just a standard recording that is, say, on my BlackBerry. I just take that. I think the thing I'm concerned about is we're talking about just collection of these issues and biometric information that looks to me like anybody collecting anything about you. And I think one of the things I heard in the questioning period was, well, what about private investigators and people like that? You have now, you have a civil action that may be against somebody who maybe wants to say prove that somebody was at a crime scene, but later on they find out they took something that was of this biometric style, and yet it may not have been a crime that rose to the level of the very crime that we have in this collection of information. So help me understand how I'm supposed to look at this.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Coghill. We have heard that the department, the Attorney General's office, does have some related concerns, specifically when it comes to fingerprints, and they did say that sometimes they rely on fingerprints that perhaps a private investigator may have collected or other information, and it is not the intent to thwart any common practices, and I believe they're prepared to speak on that in greater detail.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be listening. I tend to share the sponsor's concern about making sure that people's identity is theirs. It's not somebody else's. On the other hand, I don't want people who have to prove that somebody is who they are when they're doing bad things, that they can't do that. You know, with all the media that we have available to us today, it is amazing. I'm still amazed. My wife has one of those iPhones. I still haven't figured out even how to do anything, but certainly you can record voices, take pictures, and you can even get prints on some of those things by touchscreen. So it's kind of interesting to me, and I just want to make sure we don't get ourselves in real trouble inadvertently here, that somebody wants to just bring a civil action against somebody for things that really are common practice. So thank you. I'll be interested to listen.
I think you've raised good concerns, Senator Coghill. Further comment from either you, Mr. Ascott, or Senator Wilkowski? We do have Rick Zabodny here. Why don't we have him come forward? Mr. Zabodny, welcome to the committee. And this bill does put us at an interesting crossroads, I guess, of the right to privacy, the right for you and your department to do its business. So welcome. Put yourself on the record, and we'd like to hear your views.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Zabodny, and I work for the Department of Law. I think in 2004, where Title 18 had when Title 18 was amended to deal with DNA. Concern was that somebody who had obtained a DNA sample could get a lot more from it than simply identification. They could determine whether you were susceptible to certain diseases. They can make all kinds of determinations, and the science was moving and still does move very rapidly, and you can get a lot of information from a DNA sample, and that's why the legislation was limited to DNA samples. Biometric information like voice recognition is ubiquitous. Every time any one of us uses the telephone nowadays, you don't get a live operator, you get a recording saying, tell me what hotel you want, or tell me what phone number you're looking for. And if you say, I'm looking for Hilton reservations, the phone companies keep that, your voice saying Hilton reservations, because the reason they do that, this comes from The Economist magazine, the reason they do that is because it teaches their software how to recognize voices. So the next person who speaks with a Southern accent asks for Hilton reservations. They've learned through the literally thousands of people who have called, and they've retained their voice, the different pronunciations of Hilton reservations. Likewise, but it's not quite the same thing. Google does the same thing in spell checking. They have the translating. The more you add words, every time you type in Hilton reservations and you misspell it, they say, "Did you mean Hilton reservations?" And they save that information, and it teaches their software how to recognize spelling errors. So it is a broad area that oftentimes doesn't really invade somebody's privacy. These are not, the next example is not a very compelling example, but visual recognition software is used by every casino in Las Vegas to stop the card counters from coming into their casinos. They may not be the most, maybe we don't care what happens.
Those poor casinos.
Right, that's right. The MGM brand can have as many card counters as they want. But those are issues. They don't really relate that much to the Department of Law, except to indicate when you're talking about, for example, collecting or retaining fingerprints. We also, the Alaska State Troopers, local municipalities, oftentimes rely on private investigators from insurance companies to do arson investigators. We don't have, fortunately, the number of arsons in this community or even in Anchorage that you have dedicated arson examiners. So the insurance companies come in and they do the examinations. I can't remember how long it's been on the books, but 1870-090 is a specific statute that says that the troopers or the police can and should cooperate with the private investigators from insurance companies in arson investigations, and they may well be collecting fingerprints and retaining fingerprints for those types of reasons. I know that there's been this change in the CS that excludes governmental agencies, but what it doesn't include is the agents of those governmental agencies. So, for example, village public safety officers who don't fit the definition of a governmental agency wouldn't be able to collect or transmit DNA or fingerprint examination samples from a crime scene. Likewise, TPSOs. So there's those concerns that relate. I don't know if I answered specifically Senator Coghill's question.
Actually, let's take a break there. And I meant a long time ago to welcome Senator Egan to the committee. I beg your pardon. You've been here for quite some time. It looks like someone more astute than I am picked up on that. Thank you. And Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And page 2, lines 1 through 12, there is a section in there which sort of has the exclusionary provision, and specifically line 5 through 7 says that the prohibitions of A do not apply for DNA samples or other biometric information collected for law enforcement purposes. So wouldn't that apply to the situations which you just talked about?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, you know, when there's an ambiguity and it's in the criminal statute, it always goes to the defense. And because you define out from governmental entities, the BPSOs, the TPSOs, there's that ambiguity that means the state in a criminal case loses.
Could you restate that? Because I'm not sure I'm following you. I was with Senator Wilkowski. It looks like we've said, look, if it's for a law enforcement purpose, it's okay. And you're saying that conflicts with Section 3 or that it
conflicts with Section 3A. Yes, 3 at line 31.
So, I mean, just I'm on the fly here, but I'm just proposing that if Section 3, page 2, line 31 said a person who is not a governmental entity or who is not engaged in a law enforcement purpose commits the crime, blah, blah, blah. Would that alleviate some of your concerns?
The agency concern, yes.
Okay, so if we, and we'll get an amendment or something done, but if we put language in again on page 2, line 31, saying person who is not a governmental entity or I'm looking for the verb, or collecting data for a law enforcement purpose commits the crime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that would alleviate some of your concerns.
It does.
Thank you.
In regard to the agent question.
Other comments on the bill?
I would just... Two final points, and it's more a civil division issue than from the criminal division. When you create a private right of action, obviously that means people can sue, and we don't know where that ends up. I don't think it really will affect the state of Alaska very much, but as there was the discussion about all the ethics issues that come up, I'm sure it'll come up at some point. I did want to make a couple other points. The willing requirement for informed consent.
And I'm sorry, where's that in the bill?
That is on page 1. Page 1, line 10.
10, thank you.
Frankly, I don't know what that means. I mean, two of the four of you provided fingerprints to take the bar exam in Alaska. I don't know, and I did too. I don't know that I willingly did it. Are we going to exclude people with this bill from taking the bar exam? I suppose they can say I'm doing this happily, and I'm paying you the money to do it happily. But just as the example that was earlier raised about the accountancy examination, all members of the bar, at least for 35 years, have had to submit fingerprints for identification. And actually, fingerprints for identification that went beyond simple admission to the test, but for bar examiners to do a background examination of people. So those are my comments. There are the agency issue is primarily what we were concerned about, or the issue of dealing with insurance companies that are providing services to this to law enforcement or other people who in some form become an agent or act at the request of law enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Zabodny. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I asked about the terms of art in the definition, I'd be interested in your perspective on it. And then the other thing that is also a term of art that I think we put in this bill when we were talking about collecting DNA. Generally, we heard about the various different methods of collecting DNA, and now we're going to be talking about a much broader collection. And are we going to run into trouble on what does collect mean? And so I'm just open to your thinking on that.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, frankly, I was a little concerned about the word collect. It's in the law now, but we're expanding the area of things that you can not collect. For a crime to occur, if we're just talking about the crime, there's going to have to be a culpable mental state there, and the person's going to have to, unless you define it differently, they're going to have to knowingly collect. So the fact that, you know, I've collected your fingerprints because I've picked up one of the pieces of paper in front of you, not going to make me committing a crime because I didn't knowingly collect it. A little bit more concern, which is present language, is the retention. Now that I know I've got your fingerprints, what do I do with it? I do know now that does create a little bit of a problem, but I can't imagine people being prosecuted for inadvertently obtaining, collecting either fingerprints. And by the way, the Alaska, actually, I can't remember if it's Supreme Court or Court of Appeals, has said that fingerprints you don't have a privacy interest in your fingerprints, just like you don't have a privacy interest in your address or your face. We are kind of, by statute, changing that court decision.
So, Mr. Chairman, just on the collection, the action that we're saying they have a right to action on is if we can demonstrate, for example, somebody took my voice and they're going to use it for some gain, then I have to show that not only did they take it, but they took it with the intention of using my that identifying feature of me for something that would cause me damage? Or is it because they're gained? Because I'm thinking about your hotel voice recognition thing. Is that stealing part of my identity for their gain, or is it because there's something that happens bad to me?
Through the chair, Senator Kaka, we're really talking about two different things here. If we're talking about a crime, there has to be a particular state of mind going on. If you're talking about the civil cause of action, can you sue AT&T or the hotel? I don't know the answer to that. We're getting into tort law. There is a penalty provision whether you're injured or not. I think it was $5,000. And then there's a higher penalty provision if they were seeking gain from the financial gain from obtaining your voice and retaining it, or I should say, or retaining it under this bill for an economic benefit to them.
Food for thought.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Zabodny.
One other question.
Senator Coghill.
Remember I asked about the terms of art under the definition of biometric information. Is there anything that I hit upon there that might cause concerns? It caused me some concern. But I'm open to having those waylaid.
Through the chair, I understand them to mean certain things, and for example, the facial recognition I did not understand to mean just taking a photograph. I haven't researched the issue whether facial recognition and voice recognition have specific meanings beyond kind of our common understanding. My assumption is that they do. You know, another example that just came to mind with facial recognition, as you may recall, the famous Super Bowl game where Janis Jackson had a wardrobe malfunction. I mean, one of the big things that was talked about before that game, as opposed to after it, was how they were using facial recognition because they were concerned about terrorists at the football field, and so they were using, and I assume that was a private entity, not a public, not a governmental entity, using that facial recognition software. But there's a lot of examples out there of how this stuff's used.
Mr. Chairman, my guess is if somebody wants to bring an action, these definitions become very key then. And they would, I'm guessing they have to show harm to themselves. And if the harm is either economic or somehow a credibility to their own person, I understand one is tort, but I mean, we have some real numbers attached to it as far as the fines go. And I'm trying to figure out what crime we're going to say you can defend yourself with. I'm still not 100% sure.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Zabodny. Thank you. Let's turn to Jeffrey Mittman, who is signed up to testify. Mr. Mittman, are you on the line?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. And I did have the opportunity to testify regarding this bill in the prior committee. I just want to thank the sponsor for introducing this bill. I think it's a good, proactive legislation. The ACLU obviously is concerned with protecting the privacy of all Alaskans as guaranteed by the Constitution. And this bill makes an appropriate balance between the needs of law enforcement and the constitutional rights of Alaskans, and basically expands existing legislation to include biometric information, which, because of advances in technology, have become important in both business and law enforcement. We appreciate the amendments that were made in the prior committee and support the bill.
Mr. Mittman, thank you. Questions for Jeff Mittman, the head of the ACLU? Don't hear or see anyone. Is there anyone else on the line who'd like to testify about SB 190?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe I think I just heard him hang up, so I was going to ask Mr. Mittman.
No, I'm available, Mr. Chair.
Did you hear me ask the question on these terms of art? Have you studied any of these as far as application that are now under this definition of biometric information?
To the Chair, Senator Coghill, we have not specifically looked at any specific cases that deal with the terms, for example, voice recognition or facial recognition. There have been issues that have arisen in our national work in terms of privacy and homeland security issues that relate to facial recognition, but I'm not familiar with any specific case law that would apply in this context.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Again, anyone else online? Maybe Bill Scannell. I don't know if you're there still.
Yes, I am.
Mr. Hello, Scannell. Hello. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation. If any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Great. My name is Bill Scannell. I'm a privacy activist and live in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an independent citizen who has been active in privacy issues, not only nationally but specifically in Alaska, for almost 10 years now. And I'm calling to testify strongly in favor of SB 190. I think that this is a bill a long time coming. And just to put this whole issue in perspective for the committee, Mr. Chairman, 50 years ago, if you lost your wallet, all you lost was, you know, whatever dollars you had inside it, $5 or $10 or whatnot. And then in the 60s into the 70s and 80s, if your wallet was stolen, well, you'd lose, you know, your driver's license, and your driver's license now had a photograph on it, and you probably lost your credit card as well. And now when we look at all the things that are contained in the wallet or purse of a man and woman in American society today, particularly when it comes to biometrics, when you lose your wallet, in many ways, you can lose your life. For the tens of thousands of people that signed up for the CLEAR program so they could go through airport security foster, when the CLEAR program shut down, there were tens of thousands of people who magically found themselves with their retina scans, fingerprints, hand geometry and facial patterns being sold to the highest bidder because the company had gone bankrupt. So I think it's important for us to realize how important these biometric issues are and the role of the state in protecting all Alaskans from misuse or just poor implementation. I'd like to leave the committee with two things to think about. First of all, I think the wonderful thing that this bill does is it will create an overall policy of buying technology that's appropriate to the job at hand. I remember about 12 years ago, I was in Houston when I was a reporter, and the Traffic Commission was showing the brand new cameras that they had installed in the big command central they had to watch the flow of traffic. And it was an important thing because they could see where there were accidents, where there were bottlenecks, so they could route traffic appropriately. But the cameras were being misused because the cameras were of such high quality and they were in color that they could zoom in on individual drivers and you could actually read their lips. And I remember watching this dumbfounded that this was the case. So do we really need to be buying, let's say, cameras for the DMV that can take ultra-high resolution photographs that could later be used for biometric data? So that's the first thought, is appropriate technology. And the second is this is a wonderful preemptive move to make sure that if in future we do find a biometric program that works, that we don't waste that biometric. Because a biometric program can only be implemented once, you know, on a wide-scale basis. And if it's done poorly, or if the data is stolen, or it just is not implemented properly, then you could never, ever use that as a security method ever, ever again. Or at least not until that generation had died off. And I thank the chair, and I'm willing to take any questions.
Mr. Scannell, thank you. Any questions? I don't hear or see any. Again, I appreciate you taking time to come to us this afternoon with your observations. Senator Wilikowski, this bill has been in the system now for at least several months. Have you gotten any pushback from Chamber of Commerce, from members of Google Corporation, or anybody like that?
I don't think we have. I'll turn to my staff. I don't believe I've heard any of that opposition at this point.
Mr. Ascott.
Through the chair, this is George Ascott. The only contact we have had has been with concerns has been from the National Council of Life Insurers, and they recommended an amendment which we made, in which we changed the definition of biometrics to narrow it significantly, and we may have to narrow it even a little bit more to remove the term DNA from the definition of biometrics because it's defined separately already. But that's the only contact we've received that I can recall.
Thank you. I recall the testimony in the earlier committee about the life insurance concerns. Last thoughts. We're going to hold this bill over, last thoughts, Senator Coghill.
If I might, and I'm open to some counsel from the sponsor, but not only was the collection, I think, broader, and I was trying to get my head around the difference between collecting DNA and all these other things, but then it was also retention analysis and disclosure. You know, DNA was very specific as we were talking about getting a sample and then holding it for however long, and this goes a whole lot broader, and I really have not got my mind around how all that's going to work. And you know, we're creating two things here, a criminal action and a right to civil action. And I don't want our government being able to misuse it, granted. I don't want people to collect it and to sell my identity. But I also don't want it to create a circumstance where those things that we do as a matter of course create actions against private citizens where we are going to really lose the benefit of what we're trying to do. So I'm open to suggestion, but the retention of biometrics, especially I was thinking voice recording and pictures, you know, and those have been allayed somewhat, but not entirely. But then how you collect those things also could be significant. And And I know some of those are very technical issues, for example, voice recognition for some things and retinal recognition for some things. I know those are very specific, but it didn't seem specific enough to me in the bill. So I'm open to some suggestion, counsel, instruction.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Senator Wilikowski.
Just in response, I think it was a good hearing. I think there were some good points that were raised by Department of Law by you, Senator Coghill. And so we'll certainly sit down with both you and the department and try to iron those things out. Really, the heart of what we're trying to get at is I read an article a couple of years ago about Great Britain, and Great Britain has installed thousands and thousands of cameras all around the country. And they know their citizens' whereabouts. They track them. They follow them. And they can pretty much peg wherever you are all across the country. And that's what I'm really trying to avoid with this bill. We're trying to avoid the expansion of the surveillance society in this country, and particularly in Alaska. And so to the extent we don't want unintended consequences, so happy to sit down and try to prevent that from happening.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you. That was a good hearing. Let's go ahead and set the bill aside and turn now to, we were going to do Senate Bill 249 next, but I'm a little concerned about the clock, and we have a out-of-town witness for House Bill 108. We do have a Senate CS for that, so let's go ahead and at least get through the public testimony aspect of that bill. We have a representative from the bill's sponsor here, Ms. Pearson. Welcome. Nice to see you. And is this a CS? Our first question is this a CS we need to adopt?
I'm sorry, what was that?
The CS before us, is this the current CS of the bill, or is it something new that we need to adopt?
It's something new that needs to be adopted, Senator.
Let's do that first. Senator Wilkowski.
Is that backslash?
Backslash S? M. M is what I have.
Oh, sorry.
108.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the committee adopt CS for House Bill 108, backslash M.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion and now turn to you, Ms. Pearson. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator French and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez, who apologizes for not being here today, but he was called back to a closing in Fairbanks. Would you like me to walk you through the changes?
Please,
in this
I think this is the first presentation of the bill. Go ahead and tell us what it does.
Through the chair, Section 2 was amended to delete the language that a newspaper had a total paid circulation and distribution of at least 500 copies or 10% of the total population of the judicial district, whichever is less. The circulation requirements were deleted since these were pervasively covered by the second class mailing permit. Hopefully this will allow smaller newspapers to flourish and compete and drive down the high price of legal notice publication. In Section 7, the word escrow was changed to trust account. This is easier for trustees to follow. In Section 10, on a recommendation, 5 days was changed to 10 days. This allows more time to find and correct errors from a sale. This is borrower-friendly, since property that goes to sale when it should not will directly impact the borrower. In Section 13, page 11, lines 24 through 27, deleted all language. This deletes the bonding exemption for title providers, and the thought behind this was that foreclosures involve complex procedures, large dollar amounts, and title agencies who have no special expertise warranting an exemption should not be granted one. Previous changes to the bill. New language expands the list of qualified internet sites to include newspapers of general circulation. This was always a point that came up time and time again. So now any newspaper that is free to the public qualifies as an internet site. And if it qualifies to run legal ads, it will be qualified as an internet site. In Section 4, remove the requirement that a notice of default might include language that payment to cure the default be made 2 days prior to the sale date due to the fact that the default can now be cured up to the time of the sale. AS 420070E adds new language and gives exception to deeds that were entered into before the effective date of the Act, providing for a different time period to cure. Section 6, again, just clarifies the time for the sale and curing the default. And in also in Section 6. It states that if the sale is rescinded under G of this section, the deed of trust foreclosed in this rescinded sale is restored to the validity and priority that it would have had as if the sale did not occur.
Ms. Pearson, thank you. Questions for Ms. Pearson? Don't hear or see any. We have a couple of people signed up to testify for this bill, and one is here in the room, Stephen Routh. Welcome to the committee. Just come forward, put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any. We'd be happy to hear your views on House Bill 108.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stephen Routh, Anchorage, Alaska. I'm here on my own behalf. My law firm is Routh Crabtree in Anchorage, Alaska, law firm for 27 years. We have no client in this. This is a labor of love. And so we're representing, I guess, just myself today. Would you like me to discuss the bill, or I can respond to questions if you like?
Actually, why don't you go ahead and give us a little, you know, sort of a view of just your overview of what the bill does, and then any other observations you may have.
Yes, okay. The background of the bill, and the foreclosure process in Alaska is a complex process. It's been complex for years. It's old. I think our statutes came from Oregon years ago. They've not grown up with the internet age. They're kind of the fax age or before. A lot of the bill is cleanup. It's things like it requires posting of property at the post office, for example, but the post office now says it's illegal to post at the post office. So to comply with Alaska law, you violate federal law. So it removes that requirement. There were traps for the unwary that would come up in brief litigation in the past. One of them was a three-month limit in the statutes, existing statutes, between the recordation of the notice of default and the foreclosure sale. But if you did the 3 months and it was February in there, in a leap year, all of a sudden the timeline could be messed up. So it was changed to 90 days just for clarity purposes. All these changes were born of litigation, very expensive lessons, the court defining the statute because the statute didn't define the statute. There's other things in here, things that have caused huge expense and trouble in the past. One would be the borrower passes away. What do you do? How do you give notice to a deceased borrower? Of course, you don't. It's, you know, you're past that time with them. So there's a process now in the statute that is proposed to deal with that. I think the most, probably the most far-reaching change that has been discussed the most is internet. Today, people get their information off the internet more than newspapers. That's just a sad fact. Newspapers are not read as much. When we first proposed this bill, with helped propose the bill several years ago, we would have been the first state to do the internet mandated publication. I believe today we'll be the sixth state if we do this. And the statute sets up requirements, the proposed statute, and how you do that. As with newspapers having requirements of general circulation, the internet piece has requirements to make sure that you're not one of 5 million sites, but you could actually find the ads. So there's a way to qualify to be an internet publisher, just like there are requirements to be a paper publisher. There was some objection to that, so we met with the folks objecting, and they suggested open up to the newspapers. So that change was made. Now, if you're a newspaper of general circulation, your website's qualified automatically to run the internet ad. The only caveat to that is that it seemed like a good idea, since the internet is free typically, that the ads to the person coming in and looking have to be free as well. They can't charge you a subscription rate to come look at ads on the internet. Because that would be unfair. The overarching goal in the process, I believe, of every section you see before you is fairness. And a lot of it is geared to fairness of the auction process, how you give notice of the auction, what happens at the auction. And you might ask, why is that important? The reason it's important is that the foreclosure process is doing violence to a property right. Somebody's property is being taken away. And it is not a judicial process. It's outside the judicial process. So how you ensure fairness in this process, because the person who has the property taken away has to be positive in their mind, I would think, that it's been a fair, open, honest, well-publicized auction, so you can't have a backdoor deal. So you can't not publish something or publish it obscurely or something like that. And the reason why it's good is because if the auction attracts bidders, then everybody wins. The bank that has the loan does not get property back in its portfolio. And being a banking lawyer, I can tell you the last thing a bank wants is to take property back on foreclosure. It's killing the banks. The last figure I heard, every time a bank takes back a home on foreclosure, there's an automatic loss, on average nationwide, of $40,000 to the bank. And that's just because of foreclosure costs, having to put the insurance on the place, rehab it for resale, broker commission, that stuff. They don't want the property back. The borrower doesn't want the bank to have the property go back either. Now, why is that? That's because if it goes to foreclosure auction and a bidder shows up and it bids $1 beyond what the bank is owed, and that's happening more and more as the economy recovers, the borrower is entitled to that buck. Or another creditor who is on the lien to the property gets that buck, which goes to the borrower's credit. So everything you can do to attract bidders to a sale, to get them to bid, not one bidder, but ideally two bidders bidding against each other, helps the system. There's not a loser in that process. There's not a loser. The system gains, the borrower gains, the bank gains. Title insurance companies love it because nobody litigates at that point. Everything's clean and nice. So the goal is, how do we get the attraction to the sale? How do we get people to show up and bid at this property? It's the internet. That's how you do it. That's how we do it nowadays. And this bill, I think, underlines and underscores it. That's how it can work. The other way, it allows bidding with lots of safeguards by email if the trustee is equipped to do that, on the internet if the trustee is equipped to do that. So we open up to almost an eBay style thing if we wanted to. The idea being somebody can sit in New York and buy property in Homer. Well, why not? Why not? Open it up. Help the borrower out by increasing the bidding. So, anyway, I'm a bit passionate about it. I apologize for that. I'll be glad to respond to questions from anybody in any particulars.
Mr. Ralph, thank you. Good testimony, and nice to hear from someone who knows the business. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Good to see you, Stefan. Good to see you. I know you've been doggedly pursuing this for a long time. Appreciate that. I think there are a lot of good things in this bill. Some questions I have, and it's slowly coming back to me as you present your testimony. Section 5, page 5, actually. I think this was a concern last time, and we're changing the notice requirement to actual physical possession. To a person who's in actual physical possession. I recall this being an issue last time, and or a concern anyway for some. Can you just explain how that would work and why you believe that's necessary?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. The remarkably, this is the one that I don't recall being an issue. I recall others, but I don't recall that one.
Maybe we picked the one that wasn't, but please go ahead.
This is born of litigation, lots of litigation, and the issue was there's a lien on property, but you would not know it by examining the record. So how do you allow for clean title in a foreclosure auction process if there is a lien that's not been recorded? And there's been lots and lots of litigation on that.
Well, and if I could, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. What this section is doing is this is changing who the notice goes to. Is that right? We're on the bottom of page 4, lines 28. It starts out, within 10 days after recording the notice of default, the trustee shall mail a copy, et cetera, to the following person. And it's number one, the trustor in the trustee, or number two, the successor in interest to the trustor whose interest appears of record or of whose interest the trustee or the beneficiary has actual notice, or who is in physical possession of the property. And I recall that being an issue, and maybe you're right. Maybe I'm mixing this with a different bill. But what's the necessity of adding that provision?
The actual physical part.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you're disturbing possession of that house. Whoever is there is entitled to know that the possession is being disturbed. So if it's a tenant, for example, you want to let them know this place is being foreclosed on. So you better do something.
And maybe I misread this. Maybe I was misreading this to say that you, because I think the concern that came up, and maybe I'm confusing this, but if someone is having their house foreclosed and they have a tenant that's in the house, I think the concern last time was that you could go right to the tenant, serve notice on them, and then the owner somehow could escape notice, and you're saying that's not the case?
Correct. Yeah, the owner gets notice separately from the actual physical possession.
Okay.
There's lots of ways to try to get that owner notice besides handing something to somebody on the door or at the door.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chair, yes. Section 6, lines 21 through 26, page 5. And this is, if the existence of a lien or non-possessory interest can only be inferred from the inspection of the property, the person holding the lien or non-possessory interest is not entitled to notice under C, et cetera, et cetera. And what's the rationale behind that?
This was the one I was talking to earlier, the point of litigation, where it becomes a judgment call. If you look at property, does somebody potentially have a lien, but they haven't recorded it? The typical thing would be like a mechanic's lien. You know, there's lots of statutes where people doing work on a house can record notice on the title. So if there's a foreclosure, they get appropriate notice and they can act to protect their lien. If they don't do that, it becomes a judgment call. You know, was that board for new construction out there, or was that board for a remodel? Are all those boards for this property or for the other property? Is that piece of equipment there to mow the lawn or to build something? That's litigation, and there's been lots of litigation just on that point. So we're taking away the judgment call. You know, if you have a right to a lien, better make real clear about it and get it on record.
And if I could, is this section fairly common? And I understand the rationale for why you're doing this. Is it fairly common? And I'm just wondering what the other side might say to this. I mean, is this fairly common in state statutes across the country? Do you know?
The only litigation on this point I am aware of in all the states I operate in is Alaska. And I believe the statutes handle that separately by saying this is what you do and this is all you do and how you give notice. But there was a case in Alaska that said you're on inquiry notice for a specific thing. In this case, I think, I believe it was a Nobleman case, it was some boards. And that should have told somebody there was some construction, and you could have assumed it might have been new construction. You could have assumed that you should be giving notice and chase them down. And so it became very cumbersome to comply with that case. I believe we are the only state that has a case like that on record. Hmm.
Okay. Other questions from Mr. Ralph while we have him here? I don't hear or see any. Thank you. Oh, actually, go ahead.
I didn't want to dominate the questions. I don't know if others had. Section 9, page 8. The new section there where it says the foreclosure may not be postponed for more than 12 months unless a new notice of sale is given under 8.2 of this section seems fairly non-controversial, I would imagine. Any rationale behind that? Is that a problem that's existing?
Yes. Previously, this was left to the discretion of the title insurance companies who would insure the sale. Some would say 6 months, some would say 18 months, some would say, how do I feel about it today, and make a decision. So there was no certainty in this. They were all afraid of litigation if they guessed wrong. So this just says, here's the number. You know, if you're within this time, you're okay. If you're outside, do this, and you'll be compliant.
And then if I could, Mr. Chair, Section 10, it looks like you're changing the way that the cash proceeds of the sale are distributed. Any major changes there in what is current law?
No. This is actually how everybody does it, but it's just making sure that that we're being compliant when we do it that way.
Why don't we, before we lose the opportunity, Mr. Rothman, you can stand by, but we do have someone else online who wants to testify, and that's Dennis Fennerty. Sir, if you're there and can hear me, go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any.
I am here. My name is Dennis Fennerty. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. I'm with the law firm of Groeggers, and I've been doing foreclosures on behalf of lenders for more than 25 years. I do applaud Mr. Routh for this bill. It does important things that should be done to make the process, as Mr. Routh says, fair and to clarify uncertainties. The inquiry notice item that he mentioned a moment ago leaves the lenders uncertain of whether or not a certain state of facts mandates that they go looking for an interest in the property, and it creates a potential cloud on the property. I would note that the notice provisions are in fact being clarified and made certain, and the distribution of the proceeds are, as Mr. Rouse said, the way everybody does it, but it's been the practice rather than following the law as written, and so this bill does many, many good things, including the deceased borrower's notification provisions. The current process requires that the lender actually go to court and open special probate, which is an extraordinary burden on the lenders, and this statute addresses that in a very fair way by requiring as much notice as is reasonable. I testified before, and you must forgive me, I went online for the latest version of the statute, or the bill, and I can't be certain that I have that. In fact, I think I do not have it, but I want to make certain that what Stefan said is right, that the Internet publication, which is also an appropriate a requirement, is available if any newspaper of general circulation maintains a website. Is that still the requirement as one alternative for publishing the website notice? That would be section 2, C.
Sub C.
C1. C1. So that has not changed, if I understand correctly.
No, just and the backslash we're on is backslash M. It was just adopted today, so the likelihood is that you don't have the most current version, but I think this is a provision that did not get changed. And just so you know, it says to qualify as an Internet website on which notices of sale may be published, an Internet website must, and then sub one is if operated by a newspaper of general circulation, be completely free to the public for viewing and not require a subscription.
Very good. And then I did hear the description that the newspaper of general circulation requirements have changed, and that would be, again, section 2, little d. Is distributed at least once for a week,
right.
A week for at least 50 weeks?
Correct.
Okay, and that remains?
That remains, yes.
And was there a relaxing of the standard?
I don't believe so.
And has a total paid circulation or paid distribution of at least 500 copies?
I don't know that that is here. Ms. Pearson, you're going to address this point? Ms. Pearson.
Chairman French, I can address this point. This is Jane Pearson for the record. What we did was take out language that would require it to be 10% of the total population of the judicial district or 500 copies, whichever is less, and left it with the 500 copies, which is covered under the second class mailing permit.
Okay, I understand. Okay, then that was my primary concern the last time, that there be an alternative website available for me to conduct foreclosures and have a place to put notifications, and the fact that the newspapers of general circulation can host those notifications is satisfactory to me. And I do believe this is a very good bill, and I do believe it's long overdue, and I hope it passes. I'm available for questions if anybody has any.
Mr. Fenerty, thank you, and I don't see any questions, but I appreciate you taking the time to make yourself available to us this afternoon.
Very good. I will stay on the line for the remainder of the hearing.
Very good. Any wrap-up comments from you, Ms. Pearson, or you, Mr. Ralph, while we have you?
Chairman French and committee members, I think this bill has been worked, and it makes everybody happy at this point. It's a really good bill. It will modernize the foreclosure, the non-judicial foreclosure process, and it will do a lot of good for the state.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Mr. Ralph.
I would just add that everybody who's had a comment or concern on this bill has let me know about it in no uncertain terms over the past 3 years, and I believe we've addressed every one of them to their satisfaction.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just, I'm sorry, the notice issue?
Yes.
That's the no, you've been very good about answering the questions. I appreciate that. Notification issues. How small communities where they have these tiny little newspapers, how is this going to mesh with rural Alaska?
As far as the Internet piece,
yeah.
Or just normal
well,
publication?
I mean, the concern is, obviously, we want people to, we want as many people notified, particularly people in the community notified, I guess. And in rural Alaska, if we're taking away the newspaper of general circulation requirement, allowing people to go Internet, we're not you still have that option. But, I mean, how is this going to work in rural Alaska?
Well, nothing changes on the newspaper piece.
So you still have to do it by newspaper?
You have to do it by newspaper still, yes.
And you're giving the
correct
option of also doing it by...
Correct. With the goal being lots of notice. So we're doing two different ways now. We're adding on top the newspaper, the internet publication piece. So we catch them two ways.
So we're just adding the ability to also go the new. How is it done now in rural Alaska, for instance?
Well, it's by judicial district. So every judicial district has at least one paper of general circulation. And so that's where you advertise. And so that won't change. You have to advertise in a paper of general circulation in that judicial district. On top of that, you also have to go on the web. Where it's going to be valuable, Senator Wilkowski, is, for example, because it's by judicial district, and as you know, ours, each one, I believe, is bigger than the state of Texas. We have huge districts. So I can advertise a foreclosure sale for a property in Anchorage in the newspaper in Kodiak and be perfectly legal. Now, who's going to read the Kodiak newspaper for an Anchorage foreclosure? Nobody. That's because it's by judicial district, not by community or recording district. This levels that out, because if I got to go on the internet too, then I'm going to see that ad if I'm looking on the internet.
Just as a point of order, and as happy as I am to belittle the state of Texas every chance we get, we do have four judicial districts. I don't think that all of them can be bigger than the state of Texas, but I think the point's well taken. Thank you, Mr. Rao. Further comments? We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. It is a comprehensive bill. It has been heavily worked. It is in its last committee of referral, and so we're well positioned to give this bill a fair chance at passage this year. So thanks again for coming to Juneau and bringing your expertise to us. It's very helpful to hear from people who work in this area when we take up these matters. So again, and send our regards to Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Fennedy.
Yes, as further comment, in anticipation of this hearing, I had my foreclosure assistant communicate with several newspapers, including the Arctic Sounder, the Nome Nugget, and others in the bush, and they are newspapers that we use to publish foreclosures. They are newspapers of general circulation, and in each case, they assured us that each time you run the publication in their newspaper, they are putting them on the website. And so in the bush, as Mr. Ralph said, we will be making available to more people in two different ways, newspaper publication and website in those small communities.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Very good.
We will set the bill aside and take up next SB 249. We have a representative from the bill's prime sponsor's office. Mr. Hensley is here. Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you. Please put yourself on the record. Tell us about your bill.
A lot of papers here.
And they're all public records, I'm sure.
Every single one. My name is Max Hensley, staff to Senator Johnny Ellis, the very shortest explanation I can give of this bill is that it strengthens and clarifies the existing Alaska law regarding access to and preservation of public records. In our sponsor statement, you'll see a quote from the Organic Act of 1913, which reads, "Every person has a right to inspect any public writing or record, and every public officer having the custody thereof is bound to permit such inspection." Now, obviously, there's been a lot of things that have changed in our state since 1913, but we think that that provides a strong statement of intent that has carried through our legislation since that time, and this updates this portion of the statute for the modern age. There are four major sets of changes that this bill makes. The first is a consistent definition of what is a public record throughout the statutes. Public records are mentioned in three places, first being maintenance of records by state agencies, the second being access to records by the public, and the third is the criminal statutes for tampering with public records. Each of those three places in the statutes currently has a slightly different definition of what applies. This would apply a consistent definition in all three. The especially important provision there is the duty to preserve a public record for the agencies and the ability of citizens to access those records which agencies have a duty to preserve. This consistent definition is also consistently broad. It explicitly includes electronic transmissions within that definition, and it explains that impeding the preservation of or access to public records is a violation of existing criminal law, as was discussed in the previous hearing. Tampering with public records in the second and third degree is either a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony. And the third major change is that it amends the Executive Branch Ethics Act to require public officers to use state email when taking official action. This codifies in statute the goal of the policy of the current administration. You'll see in your packet a letter to all state employees from the Commissioner of Administration explaining that. And the issue there is similar, where items that do not travel through state systems cannot be maintained as public records. Finally, it limits the fees that the state can charge for access to public records to the actual cost of the duplication of those records, not including the cost of labor. State employees already exist, are already paid, or exist within state budgets, and this is the same definition that's used by 14 other states around the country. I briefly wanted to touch on two points that were raised in the last hearing in regards to the definitions used in this bill. The first refers to both of them refer to the to Section 2 of the bill, which is the part that requires public officers to use state email for official action. Question was, who is a public officer and what is an official action? And so both of those terms are defined within that same section of statute. Official action is not just every email. It's not, you know, setting up, you know, private conversations, the de minimis use of state resources that happens within emails. It means advice, participation, or assistance, including a recommendation, decision, approval, disapproval, vote, or other similar action, including inaction, by a public officer. So it's something that relates to or shows the decision-making process or the activities or organization of state government. And finally, a public officer is also defined in that statute. To paraphrase, there's a list A through J, but governor, lieutenant governor, department heads or deputies, division directors or deputies, special assistants, legislative liaisons, assistants to the governor or lieutenant governor, board and commission members, comptrollers, procurement officer, executive directors, and members of the board of trustees and investment officers of the Permanent Fund Corporation, as well as appointed or elected municipal officers. So, again, it's limited to those folks who have a direct impact on public policy, not the field technician three in the field for fish and game, for example. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know that departments of administration and law are here or online to raise some concerns. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Hensley. We do have Rachel Petro from the Commissioner's Office, the Department of Administration, and we have Judy Bachman on from the Department of Law. My first question is what's the remedy? What happens if a public official, a public officer under Section 2 does not use a state electronic delivery system for their electronic transmissions?
To the Chair, that prescription is included in the Executive Branch Ethics Act. So the first, most obvious, would be an ethics violation. If you also look within the bill at Section 6, it states, whether acting independently or in concert with another person who unlawfully impairs or attempts to impair the verity, legibility, or availability of a public record is subject to the prosecutions that I mentioned earlier. And I suppose this would depend on a court case, but it's our reading that a public officer who intentionally uses private email to impair the availability of public records would be subject to prosecution under those statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Hensley. Other questions for Mr. Hensley while we have him here? We are going to hold the bill over. It's close to our 3 o'clock deadline. And so I don't see any questions immediately, but that was a good overview. Thanks for getting it in front of us. And if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.